Hi, you're listening to the International Risk Podcast. This podcast is for CEOs, board members, risk and compliance officers, security advisors, and anyone interested in improving operations. On this podcast, we hear from the traditional to the wacky, from renowned risk management experts to Red Bull daredevils. There is something to learn about the way we perceive, manage, and mitigate risk from all of our guests. Your host, Dominic Bowen, will ask the questions that you all want the answers to. If you know Dominic, then you know that he is well acquainted with risk. His 20-year career has seen him successfully establish operations in some of the most complex environments around the world. Dominic has spent most of his career establishing large and successful operations in places like Haiti, Syria, Sudan, Iraq, Lebanon, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and so many other high-risk and medium-risk locations. Joined by our excellent guests, he'll reveal innovative ideas on how you can ensure your organisation thrives in areas with high risk.
Hi, I'm Dominic and I'm the host of the International Risk Podcast. On today's episode, we'll dive deep into the topic of Japan's release of treated wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. This decision by the Japanese government has ignited a really important global debate, raising questions about environmental safety, international regulations, and the risks of nuclear energy. As the world grapples with the ramifications of Japan's actions, we'll explore the science and the international risks that frame this complex challenge. And today, we're joined by Zeon Lights. She's a passionate science advocate and a writer who wants to change the world for the better. She's the author of a book, The Ultimate Guide to Green Parenting, and the nature poetry book, Only a Moment. She was a former spokesman for Extinction Rebellion and a UK director for the group Environmental Progress. And she's currently the founder of a group called Emergency Reactor. We're really grateful to have Zeon on the International Risk Podcast today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here today, Zeon. And the release of treated wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean has sparked anxiety and anger both at home in Japan, but also around the world. Now, the narrative, certainly the narrative that we've been listening to, is largely one about fear and concern about the impacts. And there's concern about the environmental risks, but also the public health risks. I wonder for our listeners, could you give us some background about what people are worried about and what we need to know about the science and what's happened since this first happened in August 2023?
Well, there's been a real panic about this around the world. You're quite right. Basically, this water has been sitting there at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant needing to be released. And I mean, originally, you know, there is a process of releasing this water safely that nuclear power plants follow. But because of the shutdown, it all became very complicated. And so, you know, China has used this kind of politically and has been banning seafood products from Japan and boycotting Japanese products, which is a huge deal, actually, that, you know, it will affect Japan's economy very heavily. There've been protests in South Korea. There's been online harassment. It's all become very over the top if you consider what's actually happening. So what's actually happening is there is contaminated water stored at the power plant site. It's been about 12 years. The water's filtered, so it's, you know, all the dangerous elements have been taken out. This is standard procedure. It just needs to be released into the sea. Now, it's actually at more risk having it sit there because dispersed in the sea, it's no harm to anyone, but concentrated, you know, potentially it could be. So all the assessments, and there have been a lot of assessments done on this over the years, conclude that the scientific consensus is the safest thing to do is to release it little by little into the sea where it will just dissipate. It will just mix with what's already there, that the sea is already radioactive. But it was then delayed because of all the protests. And it's honestly, it's just been very overblown out of proportion. I think mostly is being used politically. For example, like the relationship between China and Japan and the way that they are often, and these kind of frictions there and calls to boycott and things like that. I think it's just being used for that. But what's happened is the kind of broad, fearful community around the world, the community that's afraid of nuclear, has jumped on it and has started to use it to just generally say that the technology is not safe, which is incorrect.
Thanks very much for that overview. I mean, some scientists and even organizations, well-respected organizations like Greenpeace, continue to warn about the potential impacts of the release of this water. In particular, they're talking about tritium. What is tritium and how do you respond to those that are saying that any levels of tritium are dangerous?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Greenpeace should be considered to be a highly respected organisation because they spread quite a lot of misinformation about various different topics. Tritium is a naturally occurring radioisotope. I mean, look, we live with this every day. It's used in watches. It's used in those glowing exit signs, neon signs. It's just an element, like any element. Now, a lot of elements are safe at certain levels, but if you increase them to high amounts, then yes, there is some danger there. We know this. It's all very well studied. Now, the tritium level in the Fukushima wastewater, as they're calling it, is lower than the amount of tritium in ordinary drinking water. Now, anyone is free to go and look this up, but I implore you not to look it up at someone's blog. Look up the scientific reasoning behind this. There have been multiple reports done on it. This is what has been found. It's very difficult to remove the tritium from the water. So that's why the consensus is dilute it. That's the natural thing to do, is to dilute it. It exists around us anyway. It's in the sea anyway. So just release it back into the sea. As I say, it's more dangerous keeping it stored on site. And actually what they're worried about is, because it's been so many years now, those containers that are holding it are not designed for long-term storage. So there is actually a factor here where it's more risky and more dangerous to humans to keep it on site in canisters that are not designed for long-term use, because the idea was always to release this water once it's been filtered, which it has been. So, you know, actually it's irresponsible to scare people and say, we can't put this in the sea, it will make the sea more dangerous, which is actually, to be honest, quite absurd as well, if you consider how much of a dilution of this water would occur by putting it in the sea. And also it would be very managed. They won't just dump it all in one go. It's very managed. Small amounts over time is what's been decided. And even that, I've seen scientists say it's a bit over the top. But if those regulations make people feel more comfortable about it, then fine, you know, support it.
So given what you've explained, it seems odd that countries like China, as you said, have taken these tangible efforts to reduce imports of products like sushi that have been sourced from the Pacific. So in your opinion, Zeon, why has China done this?
Well, I mean, I want to be a little bit careful here about criticizing countries too much. But look at it this way. China has, I think, 51 nuclear reactors, right? And they're building about 21 more. They have plans to build more. They have the most ambitious nuclear program in the world. Now, every nuclear power plant that they have in China produces wastewater that has tritium in it that has to be released. It has to be filtered and it has to be released. So I'm just going to put that out there. Are Chinese people not eating their own seafood? Or is this boycott involving them in Japan to do with a very long history of conflict that has occurred between these regions? I mean, they know in China that nuclear power is safe. They're building a lot of it because they're a very coal-heavy country, aren't they? And when you're a very coal-heavy country, you really understand the impacts of air pollution. You see it and you feel the effects on health, and you see the statistics for the effects on people's respiratory systems and the increase in cancers. Like, everybody knows this, but most of us have weaned off of coal. Or even like in Britain, we wouldn't have coal here, but we'll import it from other nations, you know, where they have to live with the consequences. Now, often what happens when a country develops to a certain degree, you know, fine, they burned a lot of coal, it was cheap, it was easy. They realize actually they want a healthy workforce and they're now in a position where they can do that. So they're trying to transition to renewables and nuclear. As I say, in terms of both, they're building more than anywhere else in the world. They know that the risks are from not having clean energy rather than any outcome from building. Like, you know, building anything will have some risk, won't it? Nothing is zero risk. And I wouldn't claim that nuclear is zero risk. If you want to compare it to coal, it's extremely safe. It's the much safer alternative health-wise and climate-wise as well, if you care about that. So, you know, China knows all of this. And in Japan, you know, Japan's had a complicated history because they had the nuclear power. Then Fukushima happened. Now, look, that was also overblown. Yes, it was scary. Yes, I understand why people overreacted. But nobody died because of the power plant meltdown. Like, a lot of people died because of the tsunami and the earthquake. And that somehow merged in people's minds, because I used to be one of these people, you know, I misunderstood based on things I'd read from journalists and activists, and directly from activists who were claiming that, you know, thousands of people had died because of the meltdown. Actually, if you look at the statistics somewhere like Our World in Data, somewhere that has good stats, you'll find that all of those deaths were attributed to the natural disaster and not to anything to do with the Fukushima Daiichi power plant meltdown. The only thing that happened there is they're a bit over the top with the area they evacuated, and some people panicked and got into accidents and they did die. And I always say that actually that shows the fear of nuclear energy was much much more deadly than nuclear energy itself. So my broad point there is that quite a lot of the world then said, right, we're going to phase out our nuclear energy because this is horrific and scary. And Germany completely phased out all of their nuclear power as a result of that. They just finished doing that this year. But then what happened is Japan realizes, hey, actually, when we have energy scarcity, and I think a lot of us learned this, didn't we, over the last sort of year of the energy crisis, when you have energy scarcity, this is dangerous. Like, people can't warm their homes now. People can't afford to cool their homes when it's hot. You know, people are struggling and we end up having to burn more coal, which is very dangerous, or import coal from somewhere else. So because they realize that actually there's been a shift in both public perception and the government officials there, they actually very recently decided to reverse that plan to phase out nuclear. So they're actually reopening power plants that they'd shut down, and they're planning to reopen as many as they can. So just as that's happened, this suddenly hits the news that, you know, I think is actually something quite clever going on there. And, oh, people are gaining trust in nuclear because they're realizing what it's like to live with energy scarcity. Let's push that button again and trigger them and make them think that they should maintain the phase out. And in some ways that's worked, right? Because it has become a global news story, whereas frankly, it doesn't affect you and I at all. We don't need to know about it. Just like people in Japan and China don't know what's going on at our nuclear power plants. You know, these very small kind of methods of management are really quite boring and irrelevant. You know, if you go and look at the report that TEPCO, the company that did the filtration of the Fukushima water, it's a really long report and it's very boring. You know, there's nothing exciting in there, but essentially it's just saying, this is safe. This is how to do it in the safe way. We have all looked at this from multiple angles and here's why it's safe. That's literally it. So yeah, I think there's a very complicated geopolitical situation going on here, and the other countries should be very careful not to get involved in that. But it has happened, unfortunately. Although I'd say now, recently, it's died down quite a bit.
Oh, that's really interesting. And given the concerns raised by different groups and even neighbouring countries regarding this release of wastewater, what lessons can be learned about communicating about the risks and the safety and the science behind the release of treated wastewater, especially to a public that can be sceptical sometimes about nuclear?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a really good question. And I think these attempts have been made, but what I often see is they're reactionary, so they happen after the fact. And sometimes, you know, it's not anyone's fault. This is probably something they didn't expect to get overblown and turn into a big news story around the world. I mean, I wouldn't have expected it. Once I saw the report, I was kind of like, this is not a story. How has this turned into a story? It's actually building on a myth of a much broader scare story, isn't it? Which is based on fear-mongering. But there were a lot of attempts to remedy. So you had the US basically siding with Japan and calling China's response economic coercion. And there were some economic analysts who said that China's boycott was a deliberate attempt to undermine Japan because it would impact their GDP. It's actually harmed quite a lot of people in Japan because it's affected the seafood industry. So all the fishermen, essentially, who are out of pocket now. And this will take a long time for them to recover. So, you know, it has really hit their economy and their system hard. So one of the interesting things that they did retrospectively was once they saw that this news story was taking off, the Japanese prime minister went on live television and ate seafood from that region where the water is being released. And I think the South Korean president then did the same thing. No, actually, they went a step further. They adopted some rule where all of the government officials for that week just had seafood. Like, that's what they served in their workplaces. And I think, you know, a lot of people kind of saw that online and said, oh, it's gimmicky. But actually, I think the polls do show that actually the visuals of it are quite powerful. And I know that sounds silly because you kind of want people to look at stats, don't you, and look at the facts. But actually, visuals like that, a trusted figure, you know, that can go a long way in comforting people and reassuring them. So they did a lot of that afterwards. You know, what could they have done beforehand? I mean, I feel like we've been here a lot. You know, we've been here with the way lockdowns were managed around the world and the way different countries communicated or didn't communicate with people. We've seen it with vaccines. If you look at what happens around vaccines, a lot of the good communication comes from the people who are against them. So even though they're making up information, it's very convincing stories coming out of these people. And then when you go and you look at the other side, you often get quite a lot of dry data. Well, unfortunately, that doesn't convince anybody. So what I always say is that you have to find a way to story tell and provide context with the science. I've even had scientists say, this isn't possible, you can't tell a story with science. And I'm like, well, actually, vaccines are a good example of this because we know with vaccines there are some risks. So it's important to put those risks in context that even with this minor risk, if you remove the vaccine altogether, say you remove the MMR vaccine, quite a lot of kids are going to die of measles. Like, that is not conjecture. That is the reality. If you look at the stats for how many kids died before we had the vaccine, or let's go to a developing country and let's have a look at the stats there where they're crying out for these vaccines because there's so much infant mortality because they don't have access to them. They're dying of entirely easily preventable diseases. Then you have to say, all right, in context, yes, we don't like that there's this risk and we should mitigate for this risk. And they do, right? They mitigate for it. For example, when you're given the jab, you have to sit for a while so they can watch for any allergic reaction. But there are still very, very few cases where that's missed, and that's very sad. But what happens when that's missed is often you'll get a really good communicator out of that. You'll get an upset, distraught parent, and they'll take that forward. I mean, that's what has happened with the MMR jab, right? Andrew Wakefield published a paper claiming that the vaccine causes autism. It only had a sample size of 12. It turned out that a lot of those kids were already autistic. Their parents hadn't been asked permission, so he'd broken ethical standards. He was struck off as a doctor, and the paper was removed from the Lancet, where it was published. It was removed, but too late. Damage was done. The story's out. This is a very compelling story. So there's a lot to be said for trying to storytell, basically, and take the information and be honest about the risks, but why actually this thing is important. So what I've said about nuclear is important if you think about air pollution. The only way that most of the world has been able to reduce this really deadly air pollution is through transitioning to clean energy. And mostly that has been nuclear energy. It's also renewables, but obviously they rely on a backup power as well. And that's either nuclear or fossil fuels. So sometimes it's not helping with the air quality that much if it's relying on coal. But if it's nuclear, that works really well in combination. And I often find when I explain these things to people, they actually just straight away say, I understand that, I agree. But they hadn't heard that framing. They'd only heard the scientific explanation. And that's not enough. Facts don't really convince people. It's feelings that convince people. And we need to be on that with the communication.
You've been involved in environmental advocacy for a significant period of time, including your time as the spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion. And personally, I understand you're pro-nuclear when it comes to the future trajectory of energy transformation. Can you explain the journey that led to this position? And in the work that you're doing today, what are you finding are the biggest misconceptions when it comes to nuclear energy, and how do you address those?
I'm kind of hesitant to use that term pro-nuclear. I mean, technically, yes, I am. And people use it all the time. But what does that mean? I mean, I could also say I'm pro-vaccine and I'm pro-science, or, you know, I'm pro the sun, I'm pro-space. Let's be honest, these are just facts. It's not my opinion. You know, my opinion can be anything I like, but that doesn't change what the facts are. Now, the thing is, I did come from the other side because I kind of grew up in the environmental movement. I was very involved. I heard a lot of these myths again and again from what I felt were trusted organizations, but they were just activists with, you know, no scientific training at all, who either were deliberately misinforming, but a lot of the time were just misinformed themselves and thought they were doing the right thing in, you know, scaring children against nuclear, for example. But I also grew up in this world where I was straddling two fears. I was straddling the fear of global warming, as we called it at the time. And that's obviously become much more significant for people now. So I always had these kind of conflicting fears. And what's the solution? It's only over time learning about the fact that actually we can't do this without nuclear. That's where I really shifted my mind. And actually, I still find that embarrassing to admit, because once I saw how sure the scientific consensus is that we need nuclear energy to decarbonize, I thought, oh my goodness, all this time I've been trying to fight this cause, you know, trying to address climate change, and I've been protesting one of the key solutions. Now, that's not because I'm pro-nuclear. That's because that's what the scientific consensus is. Now, where does that come from? That comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a body that involves scientists all around the world. Now, we know about climate change because of this body of scientists, right? They study all the details of it. Their reports are very comprehensive. Their reports both alert us to what's happening, and they also have mitigation outlines for different scenarios for how to resolve some of these issues. So there is a lot in there about, you know, energy efficiency and how to reduce emissions. But they do also, in their 1.5 warming report, which came out in 2018, which woke a lot of the world up actually to the realities of, like, this is how bad climate change has got and we haven't dealt with it. You know, that risk suddenly became very clear in people's minds. But unfortunately, not many people looked at the report and went to the mitigations chapter by Working Group 3, which is the same scientists, same consensus. So this same report that has 99% consensus that climate change is real, being caused by humans, also has, here's a 99% consensus of what we can do to fix it. And it has four decarbonization scenarios, and all of them include nuclear energy. So that's the consensus. In different amounts, some of them say, you know, you've got to triple it. Some of them say more. They're in different amounts, but all of them include nuclear energy and renewables, and also carbon capture storage, which is another thing a lot of people don't like. But, you know, this isn't a journalistic article. This isn't a blog. This is just number crunching. That's what the scientists have done. Here are the numbers. You can do with this whatever you want. And unfortunately, when I read the report and I realized that only the first bit was being listened to and reported on by journalists, which was the scary bit, right? That here's a problem. I kind of thought, actually, maybe we've made a mistake here as environmentalists, that we always focus on the problem. But quite a lot of people actually were just saying, well, how do we fix it? And this was when I was in Extinction Rebellion. So I was kind of keen to talk about like, well, actually, here are some of the solutions. And that's where I hit a friction point in both my work in this movement for a long time, but also as a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion, because they didn't want me to talk about those solutions. And I said, if we're here to represent the scientific consensus and inform people, someone has to do it. But they didn't want me to talk about nuclear. So that actually is the reason I stepped away and went, well, somebody needs to do it. So it's going to be me. People who don't care about these issues are not going to do it. People who care but don't know can't do it. It has to be someone on the inside in this movement who understands the science. And actually, there's always been a friction there, to be honest. You know, often you'll get the scientists in one group and you'll get the environmentalists or activists in the other group. And there's often not a lot of communication going on there. And so that's where I kind of came forward. And to be fair, you know, a lot of environmentalists have. Greta Thunberg was very vocal about the German phase out of nuclear, and she said they shouldn't do it. You know, she wasn't saying build more, but she was saying don't shut perfectly good reactors, because guess what, they're now back to burning coal, aren't they? So that shift has happened anyway, because a lot of people have realized it, and because frankly the younger people who are growing up now, they're not growing up with those old fears of nuclear. They are afraid for their futures. They understand more about air pollution, they care more about social justice issues like poverty, and they really are worried about climate change. So actually, if you offer them a solution, quite a lot of the time I find they'd say, why wasn't this done decades ago? And I'll always say, if people were better at risk assessment and hadn't overreacted decades ago, and everywhere had built as many reactors as France built, where they decarbonized in the 80s by building lots of reactors and have maintained that decarbonization till today, then climate change wouldn't be as bad as it is now. That's quite clear. So that's the danger of poor risk assessment, and also just letting fears take hold over science, I think. So that's why I've now become what's known as this kind of pro-nuclear advocate. But it's like saying you're a pro-addressing climate change advocate. I mean, who doesn't want to address climate change? We all want to, right? But it's still such an entrenched thought of it's for or against that I still get called that. And I'm waiting for the day where I'm not seen that way. And it's just, oh, this is someone who talks sense about nuclear, among other things. That would be nice.
It is quite interesting, isn't it? The labels that we attach to things, like you're pro-life. Surely we're all pro-life. Surely yeah. We're all pro-environment. But the labels can be important, or sometimes perhaps a bit of a misnomer. But either way, thank you very much for explaining that. That's really good. So as someone who understands the science and understands nuclear energy, I'd be keen to hear from you about what are the biggest risks that stand in the way of more nuclear energy, or using nuclear energy in a way that actually contributes positively to environmental change. What needs to change before nuclear becomes an accepted option amongst the majority of the environmentalist community?
Well, I don't know if you saw actually, but just this week at COP28, they made this big announcement that these countries are making a commitment. It's not legally binding, but it's like a pledge to triple nuclear capacity. So that's, you know, that's quite a big commitment, especially if anyone knows the history of COP. So I went to COP26 in Glasgow, and there was very little nuclear presence there. There was like a little group of young people from the industry, more focusing on jobs, I would say, trying to get a bit of climate in there. There wasn't very much. It was only in the blue zone and like the official delegates area. Then the following year in Egypt, the International Atomic Energy Agency had a pavilion for the first time called Atoms for Climate. And they had some speakers and it was a bit more presence. And this year, it's even bigger. And you've got all these people, plus you've got nuclear in the green zone, which is typically where the activists go and has always been a difficult zone for nuclear to get into. In fact, I remember during the Glasgow COP, there was a huge conflict where people wanted to present and have materials in the green zone and were told they couldn't because they were for nuclear. So it's changed a lot in just a few years. And I do think a lot of that is because of the energy crisis. So people are thinking and talking about energy more than ever before because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and they're thinking about energy security, and a lot has come out of that. So right now, COP28 in Dubai, over 20 countries have just made this big announcement. They've had John Kerry come down and say, look, he literally said, this isn't about ideology, this is just science, which I just thought, this is brilliant. Finally, the conversation has moved on. And obviously, you know, America has these grand plans to build more nuclear. So I feel like a lot of the challenge of convincing people is not the challenge I was dealing with just a few years ago, that it is now about how do you actually get this to happen? Because honestly, it doesn't take that long to build a reactor. So the average build time is 7.5 years, but there are countries that have built them in just 3 to 4 years. Like South Korea and United Arab Emirates has gone from having nothing at all in just a few years, has managed to build 4 nuclear power plants. So they opened a kind of bid to work in collaboration with another country that had the expertise. So South Korea has a really good history of building these reactors really quickly, managing them fine, no issues, positive workforce. So they went in, they sent a load of their engineers over, trained them up and helped them set up their own industry for the first time. So the UAE had no industry, had no expertise. And in under 10 years, they set all that up
and have full operational reactors now, which actually meets 25% of their electricity needs. So now that they've done that, they're saying we can do more of this and export to places like Jordan and Egypt, who also are looking at our program saying, hey, we kind of want this, or we want the jobs, you know, we want to work in these places. So it can happen very rapidly. Now, what I find interesting is that when I look at where it's happening rapidly, it's often in the East. India has built their own indigenous reactor, their own design. China's building lots of reactors. The Middle East now is making these plans to build more reactors. And then we've got this issue in the West where we've shut down, right? What did Germany do? They had 11 nuclear power plants. They shut them all down. The last ones they shut this April. They literally just sent these workers home. I went to Germany and I spoke to some of these workers. No one ever talks about the workers. But actually, you know, these are people that have spent so many years studying nuclear engineering, so many years. I mean, they have PhDs, they have high level of expertise, and they have no jobs there now. I talked to them and said, what are you going to do? And they're just really sad. Like, this was my career and I worked really hard for it. It's putting, you know, bread and butter on the table for my kids. And now I'm going to have to move to France, basically, or somewhere with a nuclear program. I mean, France is recruiting a lot of nuclear workers and Britain's trying to as well. So there's a lot going on there where now there's opposition parties in Germany calling to try and reopen some of the shut reactors, which may or may not be possible. But I think it's interesting because even if you could open them, right, the workers are gone. And no one ever thinks or talks about this, but actually this is a really important part of the puzzle, is you have to have the workforce. And this is a highly skilled workforce. You cannot just click your fingers and you have this workforce. I like to think that you can build that expertise up at home. I mean, we've done it during war efforts, right? We've done it in wartime. And I really wish we had that mentality about the energy transition, about tackling climate change. But a lot of that is the energy transition. And some people will say, oh, that's only a small part of the mixture. But actually, a lot of the other part is find this energy efficiency, you know, insulating homes, things like that. But a lot of the other part is electrifying everything. So electric vehicles, gas and diesel to electric, or gas boilers to heat pumps. A lot of these changes are happening anyway. The EV transition is happening quite quickly, but you're still recharging those with a grid that in Britain, that's still about, you know, 60% fossil fuels. So even as we electrify everything, we're not solving the problem unless we really look at our energy grids. That does essentially mean invest in a really good workforce, just incentivize, guarantee that these people have jobs at the end of it, and commit to a nuclear program. So what's happened in the UK is we've ummed and ahed and dithered a lot. And I mean, we're a terrible example for nuclear, right? A terrible example because, I mean, Hinkley Point C has taken how many years? I dread to mention. Our reactors are what's taking the average and making it look like it takes a long time to build them. But some of that has actually been due to worker shortages. And some of it is from overregulation. Now, no one wants to talk about overregulation with nuclear because they want it to be nice and regulated. But some of the regulation is so ridiculous that there's only one brand of nail or one brand of duct tape you can take on site. It's this sort of stuff that makes it so slow. Because say, you know, something happens in the supply chain, you can't get this product. Hey, no one's working on this for a week. And say someone's sick in that area and you don't have any other workers. Well, no one's working on that for a week. And once that all builds up and you chuck in a pandemic as well, right? Chuck in a lockdown. This reactor could be saving lives right now. It could be online right now, displacing fossil fuels, saving so many lives. But we're just not very good at solving these problems. And I look at the East and I think we should follow some of the models, especially like in South Korea. A model has actually come out of what they've done there, where they've built nuclear. It's called the standardization model. It looks at how they took the same workforce, the same engineers, got them to make the first reactor, and then put them straight on the second and on the third. And what they found that each time, the build time went down and the cost went down because it's so efficient. I mean, I know it makes sense logically anyway, but believe it or not, other countries don't do this, or they'll build one and then send everybody home. That expertise is gone, you know. So there's a lot that can be done and needs to be fixed. Overall, I'd say make sure the workforce is there. There's no point in making commitments to we're going to build this many reactors if you have no workforce. Right now, people need to be wanting to go into those careers. And actually, if you look around, STEM skills are on the decline in virtually every area. So they've got to be incentivized, I think, financially. The regulation needs to be looked at in some countries. Here, it needs to be looked at. You know, in Britain, it's hard to get anything built, whether it's housing, high-speed rail, wind or solar farms. I mean, we have a ban on onshore wind, right? Or nuclear power plants. Everything is very slow. And that whole system needs to be overhauled. Looking at that kind of overregulation, and where it's about safety, I understand that. But where it's about anything else, we should just get rid of it, frankly. And yeah, thirdly, we need to have really strong commitments, not look at building something and then the next government that comes in changes their mind. And actually, I also think all countries should protect their power plants from just being shut down with no good reason, because look, that's what Germany did. They phased out 11 nuclear power plants. It's ridiculous that anybody could shut clean energy down during an energy crisis, but also, you know, when we need to tackle climate change. So now they've gone back to burning lignite coal because they have a lot of it in Germany, but it is really one of the dirtiest, most awful kinds of fuel. Any country that's using it should be, you know, fined heavily. I think any developed country should be, because there's no reason for us to be doing it. And I feel like that might incentivize people to get a program off the ground with lots of renewables, lots of nuclear. That's it. We could have done it a long time ago. So there's a lot of things that need to change to actually get this off the ground. The public perception bit, I think, is largely done. You've got people like John Kerry and AOC and even Greta saying positive things about nuclear. And you've got these 22 countries now happy to stand in front of a sign at COP saying we're going to triple nuclear energy. I mean, I almost couldn't believe it when I saw it, because a few years ago, you know, people would have been heckling them, telling them their vested interests or what have you. But now it's become very acceptable because people have caught up with the scientific consensus. But the next challenge is to overcome those challenges. And people really need to understand that if we don't build these, we are locking ourselves into some really terrible changes with the climate.
Yeah, very much so. It was quite interesting, as you spoke about before, the new agreement that was led by America, I believe, and 21 other countries, the UK, France, Japan, Canada, South Korea, and even Ukraine, pledged to work together to triple nuclear energy capacity by 2050. In their joint statement, they talked about the key role that nuclear energy can play in keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees. So I think that's positive that people are discussing it, that came out of COP28. And given your background in science communication, what strategies have you found to be most effective when conveying what can be complex information to such diverse audiences?
So I always say that you need to speak to people where they're at. So you have to look at where they're coming from. There's no point me talking to someone about how we're going to address climate change using these methods if they don't care about climate change. It's not my job to convince them to care at all. But, you know, often people have a lot in common. I give lectures around the world. No matter where I go, I find people have the same concerns. We are essentially just the same people. You know, I was in Australia last year and I toured around a little bit, spoke to students at universities, I spoke to climate groups, I spoke to politicians, I spoke to a very wide range of people. And they all have the same concerns. They might be in different order, but they are the same concerns. Usually environment, jobs, and health, like their own health. So if you think about things like nuclear, that's become viewed negatively because people thought it was bad for their health, which is funny in a way, because this kind of idea of radiation, the invisible killer, well, okay, yes, it can be, but the chance of you being exposed to a high amount in your lifetime is extremely rare. In fact, it's most likely, if you are ever exposed to a high amount, that it will be for some kind of radiotherapy to make you well again if you're sick. That is statistically the truth. But it's interesting with the health stuff, because when I see that it's health that they're most afraid about, I say, well, should we talk about air pollution? And it's almost like nobody doesn't know about air pollution, but we're so used to living with it. And it is a killer and it is a risk. And in some regions, even in Britain, we have air pollution that's above legal standards, which means that, you know, we had a high profile case last year, didn't we, where the little girl died in this really quite deprived area of London where it was known to have really bad air pollution. She had an asthma attack and she died. And her mother's now campaigning for air quality, trying to get less cars on the road and things like that. But people forget how much air pollution comes from burning fossil fuels. It's something like 9 million deaths a year attributed to that. And that is always in the most marginalized communities. So if you care about social justice, if someone's talking about social justice, I'll point this out. Those people that have to live near those coal-fired power stations so that you can put your lighting on, you know, and heat your home, they suffer from these health issues and they cannot afford to move out of that area and they have to watch their kids suffer. Now, these are true stories that anyone can go and do a bit of research and find, yeah, this is the truth. We've known this. That's why we'd never build a coal-fired power station here in Britain, right? We'd never allow it. And I think that's right. But at the same time, we're importing it from other regions. We're just exporting that health cost to other people. And that's what I think is wrong. So when I talk about these things, people say, actually, I completely agree. I just hadn't really thought about it or I hadn't heard it expressed in that way. But they already know on some level. None of this is news to them. Yes, air pollution's bad and it's deadly and it kills infinitely more people than radiation, which actually, when managed, can save lives. I always often think of it as rewriting stories. So what story have you been told and how accurate is it? Let's rewrite it so that it's actually more accurate depiction of the world. So if you want to look at one of the bigger killers in the world, actually, yeah, it is air pollution, because nuclear, you know, will total less than a few thousand deaths. I'm not saying that's good, but look, hydropower has killed hundreds of thousands of people. So if you want to only go by that, well, then why is nobody protesting hydropower? And again, I make this point and people say, I hadn't really thought about that. Well, I'm pro hydropower. Well, do you know about the Bangkyo Dam disaster where I think 200,000 people died? Their houses were completely washed away. I mean, dams are serious business, right? There's no mitigating that. You have a nuclear power plant meltdown, you can at least get it shut down effectively, evacuate the area. You know, it's not going to do what a dam does. There's no managing that, essentially, is what I'm saying. I'm not saying we shouldn't build them. I'm for clean energy. I'm just saying, where do these kind of ideas come from in people's minds? Because actually, they're not coming from facts and statistics. They're just coming from scare stories that they already heard. So they heard all the stories about Fukushima and Three Mile Island, where no one died because of the meltdowns, but it left a feeling with them of this is a really bad thing. Whereas actually, what they need to understand is the really bad thing is air pollution and climate change. And almost everyone would say, yeah, I agree on climate change. But when you then talk about the solutions for how we're going to deal with it, they say, I don't know anything. I just try to turn my lights off more, you know, and things like that. And I think, well, that's admirable. And we should all not waste energy. But frankly, that's not the solution. The solutions are much more broad scale, right? They're much more large scale. And it's politicians that have to make those decisions. So I always get asked, what can I do? And that's where, you know, I could say, go and inform people, because there's a lot of misinformation. There's that. I can say, write to your politicians, because there's that. And politicians will be receptive to people making good arguments. Often they've heard arguments against nuclear, for example. So it's quite helpful for them to hear the opposite. To young people, I'll say, go and get a job in the nuclear industry. Like, go and train to be a nuclear engineer. There is no way out of this crisis without building. There is no way out of any crisis without building, right? You have a health crisis, you build more hospitals. That's what we did during COVID. We built temporary hospitals so that we could give people jabs and care for them. You have a housing crisis, you build houses. You have an energy crisis, well, you build energy. You have a climate crisis, you build clean energy. You know, it's really that simple. When you want to fix this problem, go and learn to build, because we are going to need a lot of them. And actually, if you look at how quickly China's building, you know, high-speed rail, housing and clean energy, it's because they have such a workforce with these skills and we have a deficit. And that really, really needs to be addressed. So I do often say that to people who feel completely helpless and are perfectly capable of going and studying to develop these skills. But I do think it needs to be incentivized for them because it's expensive, and also because there needs to be a guarantee of jobs at the end of it. But yeah, so I try to reframe and I try to make it relevant to the person, because ultimately that's what's going to stick. There's a saying, isn't there? People will remember the way you made them feel rather than what you said. So I try to be respectful and I try to meet people where they're at, and you'd be surprised how varied it is. But at the same time, it's always pretty much the same stuff. And as soon as I realize this is what their concern is, I can kind of address that on that level. And I have had a lot of people reach out to me where they'll say, well, I've tried this and my brother won't change his mind. And I said, well, first of all, never go into it with the idea of changing someone's mind. Like, you can't do that. That's not really in your power. All you can do is have good vibes, essentially, good intentions, and share the information and leave it with them. But for me, I changed my mind in quite a big way, from something that I was really against to something that, yeah, I am now for. It did take time, and probably the people who were talking to me about it thought this isn't going anywhere, but it did. It dripped in and it went into my little logic pile until the logic pile was bigger than the fear pile. And that eventually did have an impact. And I think that's actually true. And it's almost a skill we've forgotten, is having those conversations. People just think, I'll post something on social media. Oh, it had 2 million people look at it. But how many of those people did you actually touch? How many of those people did you connect with? If you actually sit down and speak to a friend, if there's a trusted communication there, you don't have to be an expert in the field. You just have to be a trusted communicator. And if that trust is there, that person will reconsider and listen to your viewpoint. And this is actually really, really important in general for democracy. We need to defend democracy. And if you look at the polarization that's going on, it's the biggest thing that undermines it. And that has been used as a tactic in multiple ways now against us. And it's becoming so polarized. And I just think these people all have the same concerns. You know, they should just sit down and talk to each other instead of arguing over social media. I think we're almost losing this really beautiful skill of just having one-to-one connections, real life conversations. I try to do that in my talks. I always make a lot of time for questions and I always make a lot of time to talk to people afterwards. And I only ever have positive interactions, even when someone really disagrees, and they'll come to me and say, I really disagree, I still think nuclear is really dangerous. And I'll say, okay, that's how you feel about it. It doesn't really impact me. Like, I've been there and I think it's a shame. But as soon as you start taking these things personally, that's when your good communication dies. That's when you lose it.
Thanks very much for sharing that insight with us, Eon. And one final question that we always ask guests on the International Risk Podcast is, when you look around the world at the variety of issues affecting us all, what do you see as the most significant international risk today?
I mean, I do think it's what's happening with not tackling climate change. I think there's a lot of immediate issues. I understand that there's a lot of things going on. This slow issue that I've watched since I was a child get worse and worse, and I've watched the reports get worse, and I've watched the scientists get more and more concerned. We're just letting it happen. Yes, it's affecting people around the world already, and we will to some degree adapt. But if you set everything aside for a minute, if you want to put things on a scale, this is the one known habitable planet in our universe. Do we really want to risk that? Even if you're not sure, even if you don't trust the consensus, is it a risk that is worth taking? What do we gain if we decide not to take the risk? We gain better air quality, better quality of life for people, abundant energy that doesn't have a huge impact on the local environment or on our health. We can make these transitions and benefit all of humankind. And I'm not talking about degrowth. I'm not saying countries should not build. I'm saying the opposite. But essentially, I think we have to really pull together. And as I say, it worries me that there's so much polarization over virtually every issue now. It used to be I'd talk about wedge issues, like nuclear is a wedge issue, vaccines are a wedge issue. It seems like everything is now. Any topic, someone has a really strong opinion on the other side and you're going to have a fight about it and it's going to be public and then it'll be in the news. It's a real shame, actually, that we're using tools that are designed for communication in this way. And I think that polarization is a threat to democracy. And people really need to understand what it means to live in a democracy and how great it is. Even if there are challenges and things that need fixing, it is the best tool that we have that we know allows people to flourish and have freedoms and, you know, not be told essentially how to live. And we have to be able to, I think, use that tool to work together to tackle climate change. The Earth's climate will eventually change enough that we will not be able to inhabit it anymore. You know, the numbers will go down over time.
Thanks very much for sharing that. And thanks very much for coming on the podcast today, Zeon.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Great. Well, that was a great conversation with Zeon Lights, founder of Emergency Reactor. I really appreciated hearing her thoughts on the situation in Japan, as well as the international risks and opportunities of nuclear energy more broadly. Thanks very much for listening to today's podcast. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Lawson. We'll speak again next week.
You've been listening to the International Risk Podcast hosted by Dominic Bowen. Please go to wherever you download your podcasts and give this podcast a 5-star review. Your positive reviews on this podcast and subscribing to future downloads is critical for our success. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about this podcast. Consider if you know someone that would appreciate or benefit from today's conversation and send them this podcast right now. Thank you for listening and join us again next week for your fix of risk-related stories.